You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Okay, so when you think of Bob Dylan, what comes to mind? A cultural revolutionary, right? Lyrics, musicianship, even painting. But what do you know about Bob Dylan as a filmmaker? Fellow filmmaker Michael Glover Smith looked into that. He's got a new book out. It's called Bob Dylan as Filmmaker, No Time to Think. Michael, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve. Yeah. It's a pleasure to meet you and talk about this book.
You write in the, let's start kind of at the end. I said you set out to find out if Bob Dylan deserves to be considered a real filmmaker. Did you come to a conclusion?
I did come to a conclusion, and I come down on the side of yes, Bob Dylan is a real filmmaker. I also say that I wouldn't go so far as to call him a master filmmaker or suggest that he should give up his day job, which is, of course, you know, he's a singer-songwriter.
Sure.
But his film work is very interesting, and I think it the three films that I consider him to be the primary author of, they shed further light on his artistry, and I think they're important additions to the Dylan canon. So my hope in writing this book is that these films will be more widely seen and hopefully reevaluated.
I got to tell you, I'm interested. Well, I'm amazed you've seen him 100 times in concert.
Yes.
I've seen him twice in concert.
Yes.
Both times, the first was the very first Farm Aid when he partnered up with the Heartbreakers.
Wow, 1985.
And, yeah, it was great. And then I saw him later when he toured with the Heartbreakers. But Michael, I don't understand how you can see him 100 times. I guess I don't. You talked about that in other interviews. There are people who are on his plane and people who aren't. And I guess I'm just not. Explain to me 100 concerts.
Well, here's the thing. Every Dylan show is different. Even if he's playing the same songs, he never sings them the same way twice. I have a good friend who says the way he sings is like the way Miles Davis plays the trumpet. So, you know, he's constantly changing the melody. He's constantly changing his phrasing. And that's why we, those of us who keep going back, that's why we keep going back, is it's thrilling to see how spontaneous he is as a singer, piano player, guitar player, harmonica player. He's always creating his art in the moment. And I think there's something fearless about that I have a lot of respect for.
Okay, there we are, because when I'm at his level of when I go to see him, I want to understand the songs I'm hearing.
Right. Well, that's the way most shows are,
sure.
Right?
But now with
so,
Dylan.
You know, when you go see Paul Simon or Paul McCartney or whoever, other artists of his generation, you're hearing the hits and you're hearing them in versions that are similar to the studio albums. And with Dylan, I mean, I'm going to see my 101st show on March 28th. He's playing Rockford, Illinois. And you know what he's going to do. He's going to play basically his latest album, Rough mm-hmm. and Rowdy Ways. That will be most of the show. So, you know, yeah, it's going to alienate some people in the audience. But, you know, that's Dylan.
You write about his filmmaking, and I think it probably applies to the concert as well, is that he doesn't mind being misunderstood, right?
Right.
Is that fair? Explain that for me.
Absolutely. You know, he said that to Larry Charles, the director of Masked and Anonymous, when they were making the film. You know, Larry Charles asked him at one point, "Do you think people are going to understand this?" And Dylan's response was, "What's so bad about being misunderstood?" Which is crazy because, you know, most artists bend over backwards trying to make you understand what they're doing.
Michael, you're a filmmaker. It almost seems, I don't want to say disrespectful because it's Dylan, but I mean, just approach that for me. Is it disrespectful to his audience if he's making a product that he doesn't care if he gets his message across to them?
I don't think it's disrespectful at all, but it is unusual. I mean, I personally cannot relate to that because, you know, I have a new movie coming out next month, and I'm going to try very hard to make sure everybody understands what I'm doing. But I think the difference is this. Bob Dylan has been a living legend since he was 23 years old, mm-hmm. you know, and I think, I wonder what that would do to your brain. You know, I think his attitude is he has nothing left to prove. So, you know, he won the Nobel Prize in Literature, for God's sake. He knows his work is going to last forever. And I think in a way that's been liberating for him because his attitude is I'm going to do what I want. And, you know, if you're interested in what I do, you have to come to me. I'm not going to, you know, serve it to you on a platter. I want you to work with me to try and actively understand, you know, what I'm doing.
Let's go through these a little bit. First film that he didn't make, but 1965 movie, Don't Look Back. You said he may have never been a filmmaker had he not been in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's a landmark documentary. I teach film history classes, and I show that movie often in my intro to film class, not even because I'm a Dylan fan, but it's such an excellent example of a certain style of documentary filmmaking called cinema verite, which means cinema truth. And that was really kind of the first movie of its kind where, you know, a very tiny film crew with a handheld camera followed an artist over the course of a tour. And it's been imitated, you know, a million times since then. So that was Dylan's first kind of exposure to the filmmaking process. And it's a film a lot of people love. I mean, the opening sequence is basically a music video for the song Subterranean Homesick Blues, where Dylan is holding cue cards that have all the lyrics on them. We've all seen that imitated a million times. But you know, the very next year, Dylan reteamed with the director of that film, D.A. Pennebaker, and he basically said, I did your movie, now I want you to help me make my movie. So D.A. Pennebaker shot the next film that Dylan made, which is Eat the Document, and that's where, you know, Dylan stepped into the director's chair for the first time.
And that's combining the concert footage, the documentary interviews, I guess. And then this, you describe unscripted fiction.
Right. Yeah. Narrative scenes that are just kind of absurd, where Dylan and members of the band are kind of improvising. And he's just kind of dipping his toes into the water of doing that. There's kind of an absurd scene where they're all sitting around a table, and they're kind of, I think, reenacting the Last Supper. But he would basically take that idea and greatly expand upon it in his second film, Ronaldo and Clara, which is kind of evenly split between documentary and fiction.
Which he referred to as a painting.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Dylan is a painter. And so he was painting a lot in 1974, 1975. He was taking lessons from a famous painter named Norman Rabin. And a lot of critics see a connection between what he learned from this painter and the songs on Blood on the Tracks, which is, you know, probably his most beloved album. A song like Tangled Up in Blue, which is constantly kind of shifting from the first person to the third person. He learned that from Norman Rabin, that you could kind of take a cubist approach to narrative and show the same thing from multiple perspectives. And anyway, in the book, I basically argue he does the same thing with Ronaldo and Clara. He's kind of applying what he learned about this almost cubist style of painting to, cinematic storytelling.
And if it's true that he doesn't care about being misunderstood, he succeeded here, right? I mean, I'm thinking of Pauline Kael's review in particular, but he did not, this was not a critically acclaimed venture or commercially acclaimed venture.
Correct. It was a critical and commercial bomb. And I think that really hurt his feelings because even if he doesn't care about being misunderstood, I mean, this was a passion project. He self-financed it. You know, he is the star of it, along with his wife, Sarah Dillon. And, you know, he gave an unusual number of interviews to promote the film in 1977 and 1978. He gave more interviews to promote that film than he does, you know, his albums. Mm-hmm. So I think he wanted it to be successful. And I think the fact that it was not well received is one of the reasons why he's never tried to direct since then.
Masked and Anonymous, you talked about Larry Charles, who we most of us know from Charles, Charles and Burroughs, right? The writing team, the sitcom, was it Cheers? Or I mean, Larry Charles went on to have success in doing television sitcoms, did he not?
Larry Charles got his start writing for Seinfeld.
Okay, Seinfeld.
Yeah, he wrote for Seinfeld and also for Curb Your Enthusiasm. And the only thing he had directed prior to Masked and Anonymous was a couple of episodes of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Okay, I'm confusing him then with someone else. The interviewer is not prepared, Mike. What the hell's going on here?
It's quite all right. But Larry Charles and Bob Dylan co-wrote the screenplay of this film together, and then Larry Charles went on to direct it.
And it was seen only once in its full length at Sundance?
The Sundance screened it three times, and I was very fortunate to be at the third and final screening of that version of the film. And then when it opened in theaters 6 months later, it had been recut. And so that Sundance version has never been seen since.
There's a picture in the book of you with Larry Charles. I want to know about how that came about.
Yeah, so I was in grad school at the time in Northern California. I was studying film production, and when it was announced that this crazy movie that Bob Dylan had written and starred in was going to have its world premiere at Sundance, I have other friends who are big Dylan fans, and we oftentimes meet up at concerts. And so I talked to a few of my friends and I said, do you guys want to try and go to Salt Lake City and see the premiere? And they said, yes. So there were a few of us that kind of descended on Park City and saw the film. And, you know, Larry Charles was there to do a Q&A afterwards. And I got to ask him a question. And then in the lobby, I got to talk to him even further, and that's where we took that photograph.
So you were there, and you got a picture with Larry Charles. Roger Ebert apparently was there and did not get a picture with Bob Dylan.
Yes. So Roger Ebert wrote a review out of Sundance in which he excoriated the film. You know, he called it a vanity project beyond all reason. And I make the point in my book that I do think his dislike of the film was genuine, but Larry Charles has said in interviews that Roger Ebert asked Larry Charles before the screening if he could get a photograph with Dylan. Mm-hmm. Ebert wanted a picture with Dylan, and when Larry Charles approached Dylan to ask him, hey, the film critic Roger Ebert wants a photo with you, Dylan just shook his head and said no. And that, and then when Larry Charles told that to Ebert, Ebert kind of stormed off and then, you know, sat down and watched the movie, which he then proceeded to hate.
When I got my started in broadcasting, I was at WGN Radio on the North Side, and that's where Siskel and Ebert was filmed. So I would see the two of them every week, not talking to each other, right?
Right. Well, because, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, I'm a big fan of Roger Ebert.
Oh, sure. I get that. But I also, you know, had some interactions. I mean, I'm not shocked by the story, I guess is what I should say.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I want to jump ahead to A Complete Unknown a little bit, because that's, he had, you know, we're in this era of musical biopics, and the Elton John one, you could just tell was, I suspect not a syllable was done without approval of Elton John.
I mean, right.
Just had that feeling. The Complete Unknown with Timothy Chalamet, Dylan had approval, or he was involved, but not as directly, or how involved was he?
He had Dylan had script approval over the project, which means he basically read the script and gave feedback.
Okay.
And then, but you know, he met with the director, James Mangold, five times to talk about it. And one of the things that they did, which is highly unusual, is the two of them read the entire script together aloud, where Bob Dylan read all of the lines in the script that were assigned to the character of Bob Dylan. And we're talking, you know, this is 80-year-old Bob Dylan.
Right.
Reading lines that James Mangold wrote for him as a man in his early 20s. And then Mangold read the lines of all of the other characters. And as they went through the script, Dylan would make suggestions. And then when they were done, Dylan literally signed the script, handed it to James Mangold and said, "Go with God." And then he had no further input after that. Apparently the only thing Dylan asked him to change was the name of one character. His real life girlfriend, her name was Susie Rotolo. And in the film, she's played by Elle Fanning, and her character is called Sylvie Russo. That was the only change that Dylan asked him to make.
There's also a story that you write about that Edward Norton insisted that Dylan put something in the film that was not true, incorrect, but he didn't disclose what it was.
Yes, and I have no idea what that could be, but that's perfectly in keeping with the spirit of Dylan's work, because anybody who knows anything about him knows that he's always been kind of a trickster figure. He's always kind of – and you're a journalist, so I think a lot of journalists are have kind of a negative reaction to this, but Dylan is never entirely truthful. There's always a sense that he's kind of, that he likes to mess around with journalists, and that he also likes to kind of mess around with his own mythology.
Well, it goes back to, in a way, being misunderstood or being, you're right. As a journalist, I see it as being a little disrespectful to the audience. As you, a super fan and scholar, see it differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dylan is not, you know, when I say he's not afraid of being misunderstood, I don't think he wants to be misunderstood. He just knows that that's going to be the byproduct of what he does among a certain segment of the people who encounter his work. Actually, I should say this. What he said to Larry Charles was, you know, don't worry about how this movie does in the short term, because he knew that over time, you know, the film would be well received. And he was right, because look, it's now, we're talking about a film that came out 23 years ago, and they're going to screen a 35 millimeter print of this film at the Music Box Theater in next week. And I'm going to introduce it. And this is a 700 seat theater. People are probably more interested in this movie now than they were when it first came out.
Have you ever heard from Dylan personally?
I've had no interaction with him personally.
Yeah, but you're not. But and yet, you didn't write bad reviews of his films.
Correct. Yeah, but but the reason why isn't because I'm afraid of offending him. I mean, I am critical of him in some ways in the book. I do point out that I don't think he's a good actor. He's not a natural actor. He's very stiff. I'd like to think I'm not completely besotted.
No, right. I wasn't implying that. You have a great line about the Chalamet movie. You said, Dylan finally achieved his lifelong dream of becoming a movie star, only he did it in the most Dylan-esque way possible by arranging for someone else to wear a Bob Dylan mask. I love that.
Yeah, that's the end of the book.
Yeah. Well, the-
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Dylan is obsessed with masks, right? Over and over throughout his career. I mean, he has literally worn a mask on stage. He did that for the Rolling Thunder Review in 1975. And there's a great Martin Scorsese documentary about that tour and called Rolling Thunder Review. And Dylan, in a new interview, says, when someone is wearing a mask, he's going to tell you the truth. When he's not wearing a mask, it's highly unlikely. And I think, you know, that speaks to Masked and Anonymous, and it speaks to Ronaldo and Clara, because in those movies, you're looking at Bob Dylan, and he's singing Bob Dylan songs, but he's playing a character called Ronaldo in the earlier film and called Jack Fate in the latter film. So I think there's a sense that by playing a character, by wearing a mask, that allows him in a way to be more truthful than it would be if he was just being Bob Dylan.
Well, I mean, that reminds me of the Venetian masks and the parties where people would behave in ways that were a little more bawdy, but maybe more true to themselves than they would had they not been protected by a mask.
Like the orgy in Eyes Wide Shut.
Right, exactly. I enjoyed the book and reading. I did not know about his filmmaking, honestly, and I'm 63, so I'm a little behind his moment when he was most. Well, I'm going to say most relevant, and I don't know that that's fair, because that's my question to you. Is Dylan contemporarily relevant?
Absolutely. I would say more so than any other artist of his generation. Now, he's 84 years old. So when you get to be that age, your music it's not marketed towards young people, right? Mm-hmm. But having said all that, I do think Dylan is probably more successful at winning over younger fans, people who are, you know, college students. And I'm friends with some of these people who hear his music and are hooked by it and find his persona fascinating. So I do think his recent work is relevant, and that includes his last album, Rough and Rowdy Ways, which I think is a masterpiece. And he plays it in its entirety when you go see him in concert, unlike, say, the Rolling Stones, who will do one or two new songs.
Right.
But also, you know, Dylan has continued to do film work. He made a really fascinating fake concert movie called Shadow Kingdom in 2021, where he's kind of lip syncing his earlier songs. And he made that available as a live stream. And again, that's just a wonderful example of Dylan's sense of humor.
With Michael Glover Smith, the name of the book is Bob Dylan as Filmmaker, No Time to Think. You made reference to your film coming out. It's Hecla. Is that how to pronounce it?
That is the correct pronunciation.
Tell me about it.
So Hecla is a comedy about a day in the life of a Chicago actress. It's the busiest day of her life. She goes on four auditions, and then she plays Lady Macbeth in a production of Macbeth that's held in a dive bar on the north side of Chicago. So that's going to be premiering 4 days after the book is released on March 6th.
You wrote a book about Chicago and its influence on film as well, right? What is it that Chicago has had an influence on when it comes to movie making?
Well, a lot of people don't know this, but prior to the rise of Hollywood, Chicago was kind of the mainstream center of film production for the entire country. So that book basically examines 1893 from the time of the World's Fair up to about 1917.
Wow.
There were two major studios on the north side of Chicago. One was called SNA and the other was called Selig Polyscope. And they produced hundreds of movies. And then, of course, what happened was people realized, oh, in Hollywood – you know, the weather is good year round and we can shoot outside in January and February.
Well, Michael, it was great to talk to you. I enjoyed the book. Good luck at the event at the Music Box. Good luck with Heckle. I hope our paths cross again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Stephen.
That's Michael Glover Smith. The name of the book is Bob Dylan as Filmmaker, No Time to Think. This is Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you're tuning in this week, and I hope you'll be back next week. You can subscribe to this podcast just about anywhere you'd like, or drop me an email, stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. All right, we'll talk to you next week. Until then, keep those pages turning.